This is VOA News by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. security officials warn that ongoing anger over the outcome of the recent presidential election, as well as other grievances, could fuel new violence across America. The Department of Homeland Security on Wednesday issued a National Terrorism Advisory System bulletin cautioning that a heightened threat environment is likely to persist through the end of April. The bulletin further warns that violent domestic extremists may be emboldened by the January 6th breach of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. to target elected officials and government facilities. On Monday, the U.S. Army announced it would be keeping about 7,000 National Guard troops in the nation's capital through at least March, citing concerns surrounding several high-profile events, including President Joe Biden's upcoming address to a joint session of Congress, the impeachment trial of former President Trump, and the annual March for Life. The White House also expressed concern about domestic extremism, announcing last Friday that it had requested a comprehensive threat assessment from U.S. intelligence agencies stemming from the siege of the Capitol. The United States has indicted three members of the far-right Oath Keepers militia, accusing them of conspiring to storm the Capitol in a bid to stop Congress from certifying President Biden's electoral victory. The indictments allege that Jessica Marie Watkins and Donovan Crowell, both of Ohio, and Thomas Caldwell of Virginia, conspired as far back as November to obstruct Congress, a charge that can carry a maximum prison sentence of 20 years. At Caldwell's detention hearing, a prosecutor said there was possibility of additional charges could be filed as the investigation proceeds. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. By remote, this is VOA News. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said his government would be imposing tougher COVID-19 border restrictions. Johnson told Parliament Wednesday British citizens and residents returning home from a list of about 30 countries deemed at high risk will be required to isolate, and government-provided accommodations such as hotels for 10 days without exception. Johnson said he is taking the action to prevent the risk of vaccine-busting new coronavirus variants entering the country. He also said the British public school classes will remain online until at least March 8th. British schools have been closed since January 5th when the country was locked down. The death toll in Britain from the coronavirus pandemic has passed 100,000. Tanzania President John Magufuli is warning his health ministry against rushing to adopt COVID-19 vaccine, suggesting the vaccines may not be safe or effective. In a speech Wednesday in western Tanzania, Magufuli expressed doubt about vaccines produced by Western countries. Magufuli directed the Ministry of Health not only to adopt a vaccine after it's certified by Tanzanian experts. The president has told officials to promote herbs to remedy COVID-19 symptoms. The United States is currently wanting Americans to avoid all travel to the East African country. Top U.S. diplomat Antony Blinken has signaled that U.S. sanctions on Iran will remain in place for some time as Washington waits to see if Tehran verifiably stops violating a 2015 nuclear deal with world powers before potentially rejoining the deal that the prior U.S. administration quit. Speaking Wednesday in his first news conference as being sworn in the previous day as the Secretary of State, Blinken said the U.S. is a long way from the point of fulfilling President Joe Biden's campaign pledge to rejoin the deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, if Iran resumes compliance with it. Tehran has vowed to resist U.S. sanctions and has insisted that its nuclear program is peaceful. And President Jovenel Moïse will not be stepping down on February 7th, according to the Haitian ambassador, an exclusive interview with VOA. Opposition leaders calling for nationwide protests in days leading up to February 7th, the day when dictator Jean-Claude Baby Duvalier was overthrown. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us on our website, voanews.com, also the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown via remote, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A pro-Kabila prime minister in the DRC has been voted out.
In the history of the Congo since 1960, this is the first time that the National Assembly votes against a prime minister to remove him from office.
The UN urges Somali leaders to break an impasse on election process. Gambia's Supreme Court delivers a ruling in favor of pro-democracy activists. Cameroon says 53 people died Wednesday in a collision between a truck and a passenger bus. And the United Nations appeals for protection and support for African refugees fleeing toward the Mediterranean Sea.
We heard from many women that they have experienced rape several times along the route. So risk of extortion, risk of labor exploitation, sexual exploitation.
Zimbabwe journalist Hopewell Tigono has been granted bail in Zimbabwe, buries two cabinet ministers and a former prison's head amid COVID-19 surge. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Democratic Republic of Congo's Prime Minister Sylvester Ilunga Ilunkamba was voted out yesterday by Parliament. Ilunga is an ally of former President Joseph Kabila. President Felix Tshisekedi's party and Kabila's party had been in a coalition since 2019, but recently Tshisekedi said he had formed a new majority. Last Friday, the Parliament gave Ilunga 48 hours to resign or face a vote of no confidence. Noel Shiani is the leader of the Forces of Change political grouping in the DRC. He says the departure of Prime Minister Ilunga should pave the way for President Tshisekedi to remove himself from under the shadow of former President Kabila.
First of all, there was a surprise because some information were indicating that Prime Minister was sick with COVID-19. Immediately, Dr. Muyembe, who is the person in charge of COVID-19 testing for the whole country, issued a statement indicating that that was not true. Immediately, the national deputies or the congressmen were called on to vote on the motion. The prime minister was voted out by a majority of 367. In the history of the Congo since 1960, this is the first time that the National Assembly votes against a prime minister to remove him from office. That means it's the end of the supremacy that President Kabila and his camp had on the Congolese institution, and particularly on the National Assembly, on the government, and I believe that many other institutions will be following too.
As you know, Prime Minister Ilunga and members of former President Kabila's party did not participate in the vote because they said that was illegal. Where do we go from here?
Well, the Supreme Court has ruled to say that this National Assembly, during this extraordinary or the special session, had the mandate to control the government activities. And as a part of that control, of course, they control the government, the prime minister and his government. They accuse the prime minister of incompetence and inability to change the standard of living of the population. So in my view, since the Supreme Court of the Congo has ruled and allowed this vote to take place, everything which has been done today is legal.
How likely that former President Kabila's party members will join President Tshisekedi to form a majority in parliament?
Well, many people from President Kabila's side, from the Franco Memputo for the Congo, have already changed camp. Some of them are very notoriously known, such as Lambert Mende, who is the communication minister, such as Ngoyi Kasanji, who is the governor of Kasai province. So many of them have changed the camp. So I believe that in a democracy, when you have in a parliament of 500 members and you have a prime minister removed by a vote of 367, I believe the issue is very clear. This prime minister had no more backing in the National Assembly. They have voted him out. He has just to accept the outcome and go. Now, I think the issue is, what is President Tshisekedi going to do? I believe that he's going to appoint a new, they call it in French, formateur, somebody who will be entrusted with the mandate to form the government. And once that is completed, we'll have a new government in the Congo.
Well, Chiani is the leader of the Forces of Change political group in the DRC. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kinshasa. The United Nations is again urging political leaders in Somalia to break a deadlock on the process for holding elections. The elections are due by February 8, when the mandate for the current government runs out. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Somalia is likely to miss a February 8th deadline to hold parliamentary and presidential elections. In an online media briefing Wednesday, UN Special Representative for Somalia, James Swan, said Somali leaders need to continue talks on how the polls should be run.
What's important, we think, is to have an agreement on the way forward so that everyone can be confident in what the process entails. That's very much what we're encouraging. Fundamentally, it will be up to Somali leaders to make those determinations, but we very much hope they'll continue to pursue dialogue, pursue compromise, and seek to find a solution. That will also be the best way to reduce the risk of violence or disruption by those who may feel disadvantaged or left out of the process.
In the past few days, Swan has met with Somali leaders on the regional and national levels, as well as opposition groups, hoping to come up with an election plan agreeable to all sides. The current government, led by President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo, has been in power since February 2017. Omar Mahmoud is a senior analyst on Somalia at the International Crisis Group. He says the parties may end up extending the current government's mandate if they can resolve election management issues.
No, I don't think an extension is a huge deal as long as there is a consensus around that. And so I think some opposition groups have signaled that, whether publicly or privately, that as long as the process is moving along, they're less concerned about the timeline. I think it's obviously inevitable right now that the elections will be delayed in some format.
Opposition groups demand the government disband the committees appointed to manage the electoral process, which they say are filled with spies and government workers. They also want the federal government to turn over electoral management and security in the Gedo region to the Jubaland federal state. Swan says the solution, the main obstacle, is a lack of trust between the leaders themselves.
I think more broadly, sadly, there is a current climate of mistrust among many of Somalia's top political leaders. And the challenge to some degree is how to overcome that mistrust at this time, allow everyone to move forward together.
Somalia's last two governments got 18-month extensions, which were used to ease political tension and prepare for elections. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Gambia's Supreme Court has delivered a landmark ruling in favor of pro-democracy activists who have demanded that Gambians living in the diaspora be given the right to vote in Gambian national elections. The court has ordered the Independent Electoral Commission to extend voting rights to Gambian nationals residing overseas. Pandera Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The court has ruled in favor of Bakary Bunja Dabo, Gambia's former vice president in the Fourth Republic. Dabo and his co-plaintiffs had asked the court to instruct the Independent Electoral Commission to register Gambians living overseas in the upcoming presidential elections scheduled for December 4, 2021. The draconian law barring diasporan Gambians to be part of political parties' executives was also struck down by the court and declared null and void. Pa Samba Jau was among the plaintiffs who sued the Gambian government and the IEC.
Well, I think it is a good day for our democracy in that we have the Supreme Court of the country do its job by interpreting the laws of the country. And I think definitely it's a very important step in the rebuilding of our democratic institutions in that country.
The court ruling would avail Gambians living in the diaspora to be registered for the first time since independence. Both the former Jawara and Jammeh government had never registered its nationals living overseas.
The other issue it also emphasized was that all Gambians, irrespective of where they live, as long as they are qualified to be registered, should be registered to vote in all elections.
Jau says it is unfair for Gambians overseas to be excluded in the voting process. He says over 40% of Gambia's gross domestic product, GDP, comes from foreign remittances.
In essence, we have challenged some part of the 2015 Election Amendment Act. If you look at it, there was a provision in it that said that if you live in the diaspora, you cannot serve in the executive of a political party, which is a violation of the Constitution. And the Supreme Court upheld that position and said that, you know what, it is a violation of the Constitution.
The ruling would benefit Yahya Jammeh, whose government denied its citizens living abroad to be registered to vote.
If it so happens that Jammeh is now free to be the Secretary General of the APRC, so be it. At the end of the day, though, whether he'll be qualified to run is another thing. And the courts are there, the Constitution is there, the laws are there that would determine that.
Jibril Fadia is the chairman of the opposition APRC party in the United States.
This is the argument we've been making since day one, that Jammeh being an exile, it was through an MOU. It's not out of his own will. So therefore, we always argue that, I mean, Jammeh has the right to stand as a president candidate in the Gambia. But this ruling already vindicated what we have been saying all along, that Jammeh is qualified.
Jammeh has been accused of committing massive human rights violations during his rule. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is part Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 28th. The UN Refugee Agency is appealing for $100 million to provide protection and support for thousands of African refugees who are risking their lives trying to reach and cross the Mediterranean Sea. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Escalating conflicts and violence in Africa's Sahel region and new displacement in the eastern Horn of Africa are causing increasing numbers of people to flee across the Sahara Desert. Many subsequently embark on dangerous sea journeys across the Mediterranean to Italy in search of asylum. The UN Refugee Agency reports at least 1,064 people died or disappeared in the central and western Mediterranean Sea in 2020. The agency has verified the deaths of about 1,800 people on the land journey across the Sahara. It says that's just the tip of the iceberg, as it is not possible to collect data on the missing. Vincent Costel, the UNHCR Special Envoy for the Central Mediterranean situation, says refugees and migrants recount harrowing tales of brutality and abuse along their journeys. The main risk people face, he says, is that of extortion from smugglers who very quickly become traffickers.
We heard from many women that they have experienced rape several times along the route. So risk of extortion, risk of labor exploitation, sexual exploitation, rape, and just murder. Some people are just abandoned in the desert in total neglect without food and water.
The UNHCR's $100 million strategic action plan and appeal covers 25 countries that are related to the movements of refugees and migrants. Costel says the aim is to assist the refugees along their way. It also seeks to lessen their need to embark on dangerous journeys on land and sea.
We may not be able to stop dangerous journey, but we do not believe in their inevitability. It is almost too late for us to intervene when people arrive in Libya or in the Western Sahara. Investment in better services and in protection must take place along the route and not only in coastal states.
Costel says money will be used to help refugees access education and livelihoods in countries of asylum. Priority will be given to provide protection for refugees in remote locations and to give cash assistance to vulnerable refugees in urban settings. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Officials in Cameroon say at least 53 people died and 21 were severely burned on Wednesday when a passenger bus collided with a truck illegally carrying fuel in the western village of Sanchu near the town of Deshan. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé on the causes behind recent road accidents and the plans to prevent more tragedies.
Awa Fonka Augustine, governor of the west region of Cameroon, where Chang is found, says the crash occurred when a pickup truck illegally transporting fuel collided with a passenger bus.
Le bilan fait état de 53 morts et 29.
He says 53 people died in the bus on the spot. He says it is difficult to identify corpses burned beyond physical recognition in the collision between the 70-seater bus and the truck that was illegally transporting fuel. He says 29 victims in very critical condition have been rushed to hospitals in the town of Chang and in Bafoussam, the capital of Cameroon's West Region. Augustine said he had ordered the arrest of three occupants of the truck who were unhurt and escaped immediately after the accident. Police officer Emmanuel Azege, who witnessed the collision, says the truck was driving above 120 kilometers per hour on a hill in the night with poor visibility. He says he does not understand why Cameroon drivers overspeed whenever they drive on roads linking major towns of the Central African states. He says when accidents occur, it is difficult for passengers to survive because a majority of them do not use their seat belts. Cameroon's Minister of Transport says an average of 2,000 people die on the country's roads each year. Transport Minister Jean-Ernest Messinangale-Bibehe blames drivers and bus owners for the increasing number of accidents. He spoke by telephone on his way to the Sanctuary site. Bibehe says the main causes of road accidents in Cameroon include the poor technical state of vehicles, drivers getting tired and refusing to rest when covering long distances, and overspeeding. He says if drivers exercise caution and are patient on portions of roads that have degraded, there will be few accidents. But drivers in Cameroon blame the government for not investing to improve the country's roads. Amadou Gambo is spokesperson of the Cameroon Union of Bus Drivers. He says although some drivers are reckless, a majority of accidents in Cameroon occur because roads are either very bad or just 6 meters wide, which is too small. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Zimbabwe authorities on Wednesday granted bail to journalist Hopewell Chigono. He had been jailed earlier this month after being accused of posting on social media that a woman lost her baby after a police officer enforcing COVID-19 measures hit the baby on the head. The police denied the allegation. Paida Sirombi Moyo is one of the lawyers representing Zimbabwe journalist Hopewell Chigono.
The law in which the police arrested Mr. Chigono was struck down by the Constitutional Court in 2014. The Constitutional Court declared that law void under the old constitution, holding in that judgment that journalists had the freedom of expression and freedom of press, and that law could not stand in a constitutional democracy as it stifled journalists from making comments. Those arguments were raised in the Magistrate Court in Harare, but they rejected those arguments and they subsequently denied him bail. So Mr. Chigono appealed to the High Court, where today a judgment was delivered that he should be released on bail.
Were there any conditions for the bail?
In the matter that he was granted bail last year in December in what we refer to as case number ACC 72 of 20, he surrendered the title deeds to his property. He also paid a bail deposit of 10,000 Zimbabwean dollars. He also surrendered his passport with the clerk of court, and he was given reporting conditions to the police twice every week. So those conditions still stand, but he also had to pay 20,000 Zimbabwean dollars as bail deposit today so that he gets released.
Chigono has been arrested before and jailed. How is he taking this back and forth into jail?
For Mr. Chigono, as you rightly point out, that he has been arrested before. This is now the third time that he has been arrested. He sees this more as persecution for exposing corruption that he has been doing over the past months. You remember from the time we had the COVID case here in Zimbabwe, he has been exposing corruption that has been taking place in government circles. So he sees it as persecution, as a means to silence him and to intimidate other journalists, especially the junior journalists, so that they do not cross paths with the powerful figures within the country.
Paida Sirombi Moyo is one of the lawyers representing Zimbabwe journalist Hopewell Tigono. He was speaking with us from Harare. Zimbabwe's government held burials on Wednesday for two cabinet ministers and a prison official who died from COVID-19. The cabinet now has lost four ministers to the coronavirus, three of them this month, and more than 1,000 people overall. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, public health experts blamed Zimbabwe's collapsed healthcare system.
At the burial of the Transport and Foreign Affairs Ministers, Vice President Constantino Chiwenga urged Zimbabweans to observe social distancing, wear face masks, and wash their hands to fight the coronavirus.
COVID-19 has taught us an important lesson that we are all mortals. The fight against this pandemic does not allow us to choose who to walk with, or run with. He does not discriminate between the powerful and the weak, the privileged and the deprived, the haves and the have-nots. It is a ruthless juggernaut that leaves a trail of despair and desperation. But we will eventually conquer. We will eventually congregate and prevail as a people.
The burials of Minister of Foreign Affairs Busiso Moyo, Transport Minister Joe Bigimatiza, and former head of Zimbabwe's prisons Paradise Mondi, all COVID cases, come hardly a week after President Emmerson Mnangagwa presided over the burials of a minister and a senior official of the ruling ZANU-PF party at the same national shrine. Following the deaths, the country's government spokesman Nicky Mangwana accused the country's health workers of being assassins. He has since apologized following public outcry. Dr. Pamela Magande, president of Zimbabwe College of Public Health Physicians, says the recent surge in coronavirus cases was caused by a relaxed festive season when people did not social distance and did not wear face masks.
We know that to prevent this disease and to protect ourselves, we need to keep our masks on. We know that social distancing is important. We also know that hand hygiene is important. As long as there is no actual treatment or vaccine, we have no choice but to stick to these public health interventions.
On Wednesday, Vice President Chiwenga, who doubles as Zimbabwe's health minister, said the country was in the process of acquiring coronavirus vaccine. A health official this week told a parliamentary committee that China and Russia were among countries that had offered to supply Zimbabwe with the vaccine. Critics blame Mnangagwa and his predecessor, the late Robert Mugabe, for allowing the country's healthcare system to decline to the point where some hospitals have no painkillers and in some cases patients are asked to bring their own water. On several occasions in the past year, healthcare workers have gone on strike, citing low pay and a lack of safety gear to protect themselves against the coronavirus. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that's it for this Thursday, January 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with our voices on